Gas prices keep climbing. Now a gallon of regular is about $3.50. And since the Middle East is still in turmoil, prices could go even higher. The U.S. has an emergency stockpile called the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. It was last tapped 5 years ago after Hurricane Katrina. We called Sarah Ladislaw to talk about whether it makes sense to tap the reserve again now. She's senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Okay, so compare this moment in U.S. history to 5 years ago, the last time we tapped the reserve. What's similar? What's different?
There's a lot of things that are different, and in that instance, we actually did have a supply shortage. And right now, the consensus opinion is that we don't, that oil markets are well supplied with crude, whereas Hurricanes Katrina and Rita was sort of like a 1-2 punch of supply disruptions that actually triggered an international drawdown in strategic stocks. So there was a well-agreed-upon foundation for that release.
Is there any reason to tap the reserve just to bring down prices?
We have this discussion every time oil prices rise. If the U.S. were to tap its strategic petroleum reserve, does it send a signal to the market that we're prepared to use it? And does that then calm markets? And there's a really big disagreement. And anyone who tells you they have the right answer is probably lying, because we haven't really tested it out in this specific situation. And so the question is, if we put oil on the market when the market is saying that it doesn't actually need the crude at this point, will that have a calming force? And I think it's a risk. Do the oil markets then read into the situation that the United States is nervous?
Because putting oil on the market from the reserve suggests that the U.S. might believe there's a long-term problem in the oil supply.
It could. And so I think what's actually more important than the actual decision to draw down is the messaging about drawing down. It's kind of like when the Fed comes out of a meeting and signals something about what they're going to do with interest rates. People read very carefully into what that statement is. And so you're starting to see politicians have statements back and forth to one another. No one's actually said that we should draw down the SPR right now, but they're starting to say, well, we're prepared to do it. We're thinking about doing it.
I've read some analysts who say high oil prices are exactly what the U.S. needs to get out of its dependence on Mideast oil and connection to Mideast governments that have been so problematic.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think that's the other half of this. And one place where, you know, I think the administration probably has a good argument to do some messaging is we should congratulate ourselves for having a strategic petroleum reserve in international strategic stocks. It's good planning. The long-term planning that you need to do to be able to diversify, we have historically not done a very good job of doing in this country. And so, you know, in the last few years, we've done a lot to try and increase the role of biofuels and increase the fuel efficiency of vehicles. But there's a lot of folks in this country who don't think it's enough.
At the same time, I can imagine people across the country who are tearing their hair out saying, in this economy, I can't pay my food bills. And now you're asking me to tolerate $3.50 and upwards for gas.
That's where a lot of the political pressure comes. I mean, there is no one policy mechanism out there that can guarantee continued low prices of oil for the American public. And I think that that's a pretty honest message that people are going to have to realize that it's in our interest to envision a future where we need to start making smart, you know, choices now about greater efficiency and driving habits and choices like that.
Sarah Ladislaw is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much.
Time now for our new segment dedicated to those of you who prefer your movies without the multiplex. Every week, lots of feature films, documentaries, and TV shows make their way onto video. So we've asked Bob Mondello to help us sort out the good from the bad. Bob's recommendation this week, a new box set of the Dragon Tattoo trilogy.
No guy who terrorizes women would ever want to meet Lisbeth Salander, the girl with the dragon tattoo. The girl who played with fire. The girl who kicked the hornet's nest. She's a girl, shall we say, of few words, every one of them choice. Lisbeth is fierce and avenging, leather-clad, rape survivor slash computer hacker slash amateur detective. She's played on screen by Noomi Rapace in a series based on Stieg Larsson's gazillion-selling Millennium novels. The first movie adaptation was designed as a film. The other two were international hits, too, but they were designed for Swedish TV. On the big screen, that was a drawback, but it means they play just fine on video. The new box set has Lisbeth sleuthing in the original Swedish.
Tänk om det är någon slags kod.
and also dubbed.
What if it's a code?
For those who just can't bear to take their eyes off Noomi Rapace, extras include a documentary about the author, as well as interviews, including one with a leading lady who, considering her screen persona, is almost disconcertingly cute and chatty.
Did you immediately see yourself in the role?
Yeah, but I always do. So, you know, I can read about, you know, a middle-aged man and I see myself in a way.
Having been passed over for the American remakes, Rapace will soon co-star with Robert Downey Jr. in his next Sherlock Holmes mystery. But for anyone who watches this boxed set, it'll be hard to forget her as a girl with a dragon tattoo who plays with fire and kicks the hell out of hornets' nests. I'm Bob Mondello.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
And our last word in business is about Russia's effort to develop a remote eastern part of the country.
Bright light city, gonna set my soul, gonna set my soul on fire.
The word is Lost Siberia. Businessweek magazine reports that Russian officials plan to build a lavish gambling resort in the snowy Altai Republic. The idea is to create jobs and stimulate new businesses. They're budgeting $1 billion for more than a dozen casinos and palatial hotels for up to 3,000 visitors. One problem, right now there's no electricity in that area of Siberia. Workers are laying down the first lines, and until the Las Vegas of Siberia is built, one of those workers advises, better to go to the Las Vegas of Las Vegas. And that's the Business News on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Ari Shapiro.
Viva Las Vegas with your neon flashing and your one-armed bandits crashing. All those hopes down the drain. Viva Las Vegas, turning day into nighttime, turning night into daytime. If you see it once, you'll never be the same again.
The space shuttle Discovery is making its final homecoming. The beloved spaceship is scheduled to land later this morning. Its next voyage will be to a museum. As NASA retires its shuttle fleet, even some small museums think they have a shot at landing a spaceship that could rocket them into the big time. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports.
A couple of years ago, Zach Cummings was driving to his job at a Texas oil field engineering firm. He was listening to a morning talk show, and the radio guys said NASA was accepting requests from places that wanted to get a used space shuttle.
So they were just kind of giggling about it and joking on the radio.
Cummings happens to be passing the campus of Texas A&M University, where he'd gone to school.
I thought, wow, what a great idea. Wouldn't it be nice if we could get it in Texas?
Now, you might think any retired shuttle headed for Texas would go to Houston, home of Mission Control. And indeed, the Space Center in Houston has requested one. But Cummings thought, why not my town? And so it came to pass that he got a new job, drumming up support for bringing a shuttle to the Brazos Valley in Texas. Deborah Kalman runs the local Natural History Museum. It exhibits things like minerals and fossils.
When you first walk in, I think one of the things you would be struck with is a complete skeleton of a Ice Age cave bear.
But her vision is that a space shuttle will be the centerpiece of an expanded museum built on the campus of Texas A&M, near the library of a former president who likes the idea and says so on the museum's website.
Howdy. I'm President George Bush, and I invite you to participate in an exciting opportunity to obtain a retired space shuttle and display it in an expansion of the Brazos Valley Museum of Natural History.
We have managed to become a very serious contender.
You think you have a real shot at it?
Oh, definitely. I definitely think that we are going to get one of the shuttles.
The trouble is, other museums also think they'd be the perfect showcase. 21 museums, to be precise. NASA only has 3 shuttles, and one of them, Discovery, is basically promised to the Smithsonian. You do the math.
It's going to be a tough decision.
Bob Schraus is managing the selection process for NASA. He says NASA Administrator Charles Bolden is considering all the options.
At this point, I think anything is possible.
The lucky museums will have to pay about $29 million to prepare and transport the shuttle, and they have to display it indoors. Museums are going all out to impress NASA. Some efforts go way beyond letter-writing campaigns. Seattle's Museum of Flight is already building a huge new exhibit hall with glass walls. All that's missing is the spaceship. Doug King runs the museum.
Almost everybody that you can find says to me, when are we going to get the shuttle? When are we going to hear about the shuttle? It's become a community event.
And if his community is passionate, imagine how folks feel in Florida, where the space shuttles have been their pride and joy for three decades.
Every launch of the space shuttle program left here from Kennedy, and more than half of those came back and landed here.
Bill Moore is head of the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex. It's planning a $100 million exhibit that will suspend a shuttle in the air to make it look like it's in orbit. Moore says it's only natural that a shuttle would retire in Florida. If one doesn't, the local reaction will be not good.
I think people would be beyond disappointed. This would be a very emotional decision were it not to be placed here.
For Florida's Space Coast and all the other places hoping to bring a bit of history home, the Day of Reckoning is April 12th. That's when NASA says it will reveal the spaceship's final destinations. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. James Gleick has written a book that is about nearly everything. And I may be being overly cautious to insert that nearly. The book is called The Information, A History, A Theory, A Flood. It is about jungle drums, language, Morse code, telegraphy, telephony, quantum mechanics, thermodynamics, genetics, and much more. It's the story of how we came to speak of what's in our DNA and what's in our brains and what matter is as information, not just in a passing metaphorical way, but in the stuff of serious, rigorous scientific discourse. James Gleick, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
And is it fair to say that information is now the overarching concept for our times that describes how scientists across many disciplines see their work in common?
Yes, it's fair to say that information is, we now know, the vital principle of our world. It's what the world runs on. And we've been talking about the information age for 50 years now. It's more than just a metaphor. Information is really the currency that's most important to us.
There are many individuals who figure in the story as you tell it, but one stands out and nearly survives to page 400, and that is Claude Shannon. I want you to tell us who Claude Shannon was and how important he was.
Well, he was an engineer and a mathematician, born in the Midwest of the United States in the early part of the 20th century, who at Bell Labs, at a particular point in time in 1948, created what is now called information theory. He was the first person to use the word bit as a scientific unit of measuring this funny abstract thing that until this point in time, scientists had not thought of as a measurable scientific quantity.
A bit being a kind of an either-or choice, a toggle switch.
That's right. The irreducible quantum of information, yes or no, either or, on or off if it's an electrical circuit. And, of course, we all know that that's what our computers are filled with, all that information in the forms of ones and zeros.
There's a concept that Claude Shannon applied to language and information, the concept of entropy. And it used to be that I didn't understand this concept very well as one of thermodynamics and dissipated energy. Now I also don't understand it entirely as a concept of information. I want you to explain, what does entropy have to do with information?
Well, no one understands it. And in fact, when Claude Shannon first wrote his paper and made a connection between information and the thermodynamic concept of entropy, a rumor started around Bell Labs that the great atomic physicist John von Neumann had suggested to Shannon, just use the word entropy. No one will know what you're talking about, and everyone will be scared to doubt you. But there is a deep connection there. You know, entropy is associated thermodynamically in systems involving heat with disorder. And in an analogous way, information is associated with disorder, which seems paradoxical. But when you think about it, a bit of information is a surprise. If you already knew what the message contained, there would be no new information in it. And so information equals disorder, and disorder equals entropy, and a lot of physicists have been both scratching their heads and making scientific progress ever since.
Now, as I was reading your book, The Information, I was trying to grapple with this notion that everything is information, that information scientifically describes all things, and for some reason the moon occurred to me. I understand one could imagine memes, kind of ideas that have a lot of legs and relevance about the man in the moon or the moon being made of cream cheese or people who are influenced by the moon being lunatics. But I kept wondering, I mean, doesn't the moon exist in a way that without our perceiving it isn't information, it's just something, it's matter, it's substance. And information only enters the picture when we start observing and thinking about it.
That's what you'd think. And it's hard to get past that. I'm not suggesting that physicists have given up on the idea that there are such things as matter and energy, far from it. But physicists have started to talk as though at the fundamental core of things lies information. The great late physicist John Archibald Wheeler, who was the last surviving collaborator of both Einstein and Bohr, had an expression. He would say, it from bit. Matter is based ultimately on information. Binary yes or no choices are at the root of things. Now, it sounds mystical, and I can't pretend that I fully understand it either, but it's just one of the many ways in which scientists have discovered a conception of information that helps them solve problems in a whole range of disciplines.
Well, James Glick, thank you very much for talking with us.
Robert, it's been my pleasure.
James Glick is the author of The Information, A History, A Theory, A Flood. He spoke with us from Key West, Florida.
The Archbishop of Philadelphia has suspended 21 priests connected to allegations of child sex abuse. Yesterday's move was the latest in a series of actions by the Archdiocese to deal with findings in a grand jury report released last month. From member station WHYY in Philadelphia, Elizabeth Fiedler reports.
Cardinal Justin Regali says he's sorry for the harm done to the victims of sexual abuse and is determined to work for a solution that deals effectively with this issue in the church. Regali says he knows for many people their trust in the church has been shaken, and he prays his efforts to address their concerns will help rebuild that trust. Regali took the actions after a grand jury report accused a Monsignor, three priests, and a parochial school teacher of abusing kids or failing to prevent abuse by others. It also said that as many as 37 priests remained in active ministry with allegations or reports of inappropriate behavior or sexual abuse of minors. To review cases of accused priests in active ministry, the Archdiocese brought on Gina Maisto Smith, a former Philadelphia assistant district attorney who prosecuted child sexual assault cases.
I conducted with my team and the assistance of a forensic psychiatrist the initial review, and I made recommendations to the cardinal based on that initial review, and he accepted those recommendations.
In addition to the 21 suspended priests, three others were placed on administrative leave after the report was released in February. The Archdiocese says eight priests were not placed on leave because the initial independent examination of the cases found no further investigation is warranted.
It would be incredibly naive for anybody to think that the mere suspension of these men somehow signifies a new day in the Archdiocese.
That's David Clossy, the executive director of SNAP, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests.
Anytime a credibly accused child molester is publicly identified or suspended, kids are safer. However, it's crucial to remember that the grand jury found widespread fault and deceit and recklessness by church officials. So while this is a long overdue and welcome step, it's only a very partial first step.
Patrick Wall calls this a historic moment. He's a former Roman Catholic priest who is now a canon lawyer in California. He has worked on pre-sex abuse cases across the country. He says the grand jury report and the moves by the Archdiocese are significant.
This report takes it to another level because they go after the vicar for clergy. That person who has the authority of the Archbishop, Justin Rangali, to, you know, handle priest affairs and priest assignments. And that person now is being called to justice.
And Wall says the Philadelphia situation could affect litigation across the U.S.
It really does change the face of things because not only can we look to the bishop or the religious superior, but now we can specifically look at how different lower mid-level managers could be charged with child endangerment.
Gina Maisto-Smith will now lead a team of experts to investigate each of the cases to determine if the priest should be returned to ministry or removed from ministry. For NPR News, I'm Elizabeth Fiedler in Philadelphia.